Okay, I went into considerable detail last time in describing the organization of the government, and some of you, I think, may have wondered, well, why is he taking all this trouble to explain the setup of the government and why it came out the way it did and why groups were in this part and groups in this part? And that is, you can't really understand today's lecture without the background information that's provided last time. Now, once again, let me just give you this family tree of the early Hasmonean rulers, rather, actually the ones that go pretty much towards the end, starting off with Simon, and then his son John Hyrcanus, and then the two sons of John Hyrcanus, the oldest, Judah Aristobulus, who is married to Salome Alexandra, who then, after the death of the older brother, married his younger brother, Jonathan Alexander, and then we have the two sons of Jonathan Alexander, the older being Hyrcanus, the second, and the younger being Aristobulus, the second. These two names becoming popular family names. Simon ruled from 142 to 134 BC. John Hyrcanus from 134 BC to 104 BC. Judah Aristobulus from 104 BC to 103 BC, when Jonathan Alexander became the ruler in 103 and ruled until 76 BC. I'm not going to put in the remaining dates at this time. You'll see and understand why as we go through today's lecture. Okay. Simon set up the government that was designed to run the state with himself as the chief executive, administratively speaking, the commander-in-chief of the armies, a position that had been in his family for now more than 20 years, inherited from his brother Jonathan, who inherited from his brother Judah, also being the high priest by appointment of the Seleucid ruler. That high priesthood is now enjoyed by descent in this family, as a result of his brother Jonathan receiving that particular appointment. And again, I think it's important that we recognize that this family of high priests enjoyed that high office not because they were in the traditional line of Tzadok and therefore enjoyed it by right of descent from this high priest of King Solomon over almost a thousand years before them, but because they were appointed to that position by the Seleucid ruler. Now, that's something we have to sort of file away in our ready-to-retrieve file in our minds, because that will become relevant once we enter into the Roman period as to how and why the high priesthood functioned as it did in that period. Simon set up the government with a consultative legislative body, which we are calling by its Aramaic term, the Sanhedrin, the Hebrew being the Cheva HaYehudim, the Council of the Jews, but that this body of 120 people, composed of the various important representative groups in the nation, the secular nobles, the priests, the scribes, and the tribal elders, was too unwieldy to serve as a top-level advisory administrative cabinet, like our cabinet here in the United States with its various department heads. And so he selected out from these people in the Sanhedrin those with the greatest degree of administrative experience, those secular landowners that had been large landowners, therefore had the responsibility of managing large estates, and therefore, you know, were used to handling large sums of money, as well as making major decisions that affected profit and loss, and also were experienced as a result in handling large numbers of people who worked under them. not just who did the actual grunt work, but also handling various supervisors under them who directly supervised the people that did the grunt work. So these were experienced managers, comparable to business executives in our society who are tapped by government leaders to become administrative department heads. Also, there was among the priests, and had been for quite a period of time, since the late Persian period, a group of priests who, because of ability and exposure and practice, were good administrators. Now, this smaller group of people, secular nobles and administrative priests, served as an advisory administrative cabinet to the ruler and as heads of department. And in order to distinguish this smaller group from the larger group, I'm using the Greek form of the word Sanhedrin, Synhedrion. So if you keep your ears attuned, I hope you will hear the difference between Synhedrion and Sanhedrin. I'll try to overemphasize it to make it easier for you. So looking at the administrative structure in a simple form, we have Simon at the top as the chief executive, commander-in-chief, high priest, so forth. And under him, he has the small administrative cabinet, or Synhedrion. And we have the, I'll call it legislature. It's not exactly correct because they didn't do a lot of initiating of laws as much as considering laws proposed by Simon or the administration to see if they were in conformity with the Torah and the oral law. So I'm going to put the word legislature in quotes here, which we're calling the Sanhedrin. Now, because of the different makeup of these bodies, the ones who play the leading role in the Sanhedrin, the advisory legislative body, were the scribes, because their main function was to consider major administrative policies and new laws proposed by the ruler to see if they were in conformity with the oral and written laws. And the ones who were the experts on that, of course, were the scribes, who, by this period of time, were predominantly laymen, though there were still some priests who were scribes, but now had become predominantly a layman body. And this was their main concern. And since they had the expertise, the other members of this body tended to follow their lead, you might say. And so although not all of the members were scribes, they tended to dominate this particular body. And these scribes, during this period, not immediately, this is a little bit fuzzy in our understanding, begin to be known as Pharisees. Now, so therefore I'm saying that the Sanhedrin, the legislative or consultative legislative body, was a Pharisee-dominated body. I'm not saying it was all Pharisee, but it was Pharisee-dominated. Now, where did this term Pharisee come from? Again, we cannot answer that question with certainty. There are a number of different opinions on it, as well as exactly when the term began to be used. Though most authorities believe the term Pharisee and the companion term Sadducee began to be used in this period of time, either in Simon's rule or certainly by the time of John Hyrcanus, his son. So it's in this general time period. Now, the word Pharisee seems to come from the root word in Hebrew, of which means to separate. To separate. It seems to derive from the Hebrew word, actually the Hebrew verb, which means to separate. Now, in what sense does it mean that they separated? I think you will see more, at least one immediate reason why these scribes would have an association with the verb to separate. to separate what?
Secular from non-secular.
Right. And also to separate matters pertaining to the law. They were experts on the law, so they could separate, you know, what should be done from what shouldn't be done. So this probably relates to their knowledge of the law. And I'm using the term the law to include both written and oral. And their ability to separate between the secular and the religious. Now, there's another dimension of meaning involving separation, which will become a little evident later on, which may also be involved in this term Pharisee. Now, while this legislative body, Sanhedrin, was Pharisee-dominated, the Synhedrin tended to be Sadducee-dominated. Oops. It was Sadducee-dominated. Sadducee is spelled S-A-D-D-U-C-E-E. Now, the term Sadducee, again, we are not certain of its origins, but it seems to be related to the fact that the ones who would have played the leading role in this administrative cabinet, made up of secular nobles and high-ranking, administratively talented priests, were the priests because of their status as priests, which always placed them very high in the social system in Judea. And the word Sadducee seems to derive from the Hebrew Sadok, which was, of course, the name of the founder of the high priestly line back in the days of Solomon. This is the generally held view. Although there are others that are sometimes advanced, this is still the one where most of the scholars would subscribe to. That the term Sadducee is derived from the Hebrew Sadok because it refers to those who are the priestly party. They may not all have been priests, but at least they belong to the party headed by the priests. Now, we shouldn't see these as political parties like Republicans and Democrats in the United States, or conservatives and Labour in Britain, or I'm afraid liberals and conservatives in Canada. Get a few nods. I got that straight. I'm sorry I can't comment about other countries than that. It's not exactly the same, but they do begin to approximate very different philosophies as to how government should be run. And although we're not dealing with the elections per se, they do bear a resemblance to political parties, because the essence of a difference between a political party and another one is they have a different philosophy of what kind of policies the government should follow, and what kinds of things the government should not get involved with. What kind of laws are best for the society, and what kind of laws should not be promulgated. So it's a philosophical approach to government, the extent of government, and the content of laws and administration that cause people to separate out into political parties. So in a way, we could compare them to that, but be careful that we don't make the analogy too close. Now, as time went on in Simon's rule, tension began to develop between the Synhedrion and the Sanhedrin. Now, why do you think tension would develop between these two groups? What is a simple, just organizational reason why it would exist, which would apply to any government with a legislative and an administrative or executive department? It's just in the nature of the beast, and what's the reason there, Mike?
It's a power struggle.
Well, it's not so much the religious and civil authorities. That's what I mean. I want to take that out of that. That's why I said almost any government set up with a legislative branch and an administrative or executive branch is going to experience tension. Why? It's just almost always going to be there. Dave?
I have a question first. On Friday, you talked about the fact that
many members out of necessity of the Sanhedrin were also in the Sanhedrin.
Yeah, well, all the members of the Sanhedrin were members in the Sanhedrin. But yeah, exactly. They would, you know, so to speak, vote in this body for what they approved of or disapproved of. But the majority of the members were not in the Sanhedrin. Now, the secular nobles in the larger body would tend to follow the lead of the small administrative cabinet. But usually the tribal elders would be more swayed by the scribes, you see. And the remaining priests, being not such high-powered legislative types, tended to also follow the scribal lead. And so therefore the scribes were able to muster, let's say, a majority of the votes in the larger body, if it really got down to a gut issue. And therefore it was still a Pharisee-dominated body, in the sense that their voice is what seemed to carry, not that there were more of them in the body. You see. Yes, Barat?
Yes, the administrative body would want to try and push through the laws as quickly as possible, whereas the legislature would say, look, give us time to consider this, and, you know, if we feel it's okay, we'll pass it on.
Okay, now why is it that administrators are eager for quick answers on what they can and can't do? I mean, why are they pressing for quick decisions? What's in the nature of their work that sort of leads them to do that? Dan?
Would they be more elected?
No, they're appointed by Simon for that position. But it has nothing to do with their origin or their office. Kevin?
By making the fact known that the members of the Sanhedrin were great administrators and managers, every manager gets things done, and he doesn't like to... He likes to make a decision, have it made, and then move on. He doesn't like it weighing in the balance and having to wait to see how it's going to turn out.
Right, because if he has a problem to solve and there is no policy to guide him, and he has to wait for this other body to deliberate for 6 months to decide what policy should guide him in making his decision, it remains an open file on his desk. And that's not the managerial mind. You want to close the file as quickly as possible and move on, as Kevin said, to other problems. That's just the administrative get-it-done mentality. So it has nothing to do with their differences in philosophy. It's just a matter of what their needs are as administrators, as opposed to the more leisurely approach of this body, because the scribes want to consider it carefully and weigh all the applicable parts of the written law and the oral law, because they want to be sure nothing is in conflict with the way God would want it done. And so they feel it's more important to take time and consider this carefully than to make quick decisions. And since they're not burdened with the responsibilities of not making quick decisions, they find it hard to sympathize with the needs of the administrators, you see. And this is not an unusual problem. In government, is that the legislature doesn't have to bear the actual burden of the unsolved problems, you see. Therefore, they are not in as much of a hurry to resolve these problems. And the administrators feel the need is right now, we've got to make a decision and move on to other problems. We're always getting new ones coming across our desks. So tension began to build up between the two. Secondarily, as administrators, they would evaluate facts and what facts would seem to be the most important to them in terms of what decision should be made. It would not always be the religiously involved motives, but it would be the things that were practical. The things that were practical would appeal to them more, that regardless of their religious significance. While the legislature, in this case now we're getting into the particular situation that existed in Judea, would prefer a more cumbersome administrative policy if it made it more compatible with religion. For example, in Israel today, because of the strong influence of religious parties in their parliament and government, the airline, the national airline, does not fly on the Sabbath. It will not leave a foreign city at any point in time where they would have to land in Israel after the Sabbath. It will not leave Israel until the Sabbath is over. And this is something that has been pushed through by the influence of the religious parties in the government, much to the dismay of the administrators of the airline, because they say it puts us in a very bad competitive position with other airlines. On the one hand, the government says the airline may not work on the Sabbath, but the airport workers do, because they service all the foreign airlines that work on the Sabbath. So, you know, this, they say this is, you know, this is just hurting us. It doesn't seem to you're tolerating Sabbath breaking, it seems, but you're only making it incumbent on the national airline not to do it. And so there's an economic price, but the religious leaders feel it's worth the economic price to be faithful and not break the Sabbath. And the administrators say, but it's losing money, you see. That's what they think of, primarily. They are forced, of course, to be kosher, which doesn't mean what we understand. Sometimes we use that term and think that we keep kosher, and we don't keep kosher. We keep the laws of clean and unclean meats. They go beyond that, of course, to separate sets of dishes for milk things and meat things that never get mixed together, and silverware and so on. But in every government hospital, in every government military camp, they have to have completely separate utensils for meat dishes and for dairy dishes, and, you know, whether it's dishes and glassware and silverware and so on, everything has to be duplicated. And in army kitchens, you know, that are fixed installations, I don't mean out in the field, permanent installations, they have to have two separate kitchens with separate ovens, separate refrigerators, separate sinks, the whole thing duplicated so that you could serve all the men out of one kitchen. Yet you have two, in other words, you have 2,000 men on the base, you need a kitchen that can serve 4,000 because you'll only be using one at a time. You see, so that's extra expense. Now, to the administrative mind, this becomes rather difficult. So you can understand that tension begins to develop between these two bodies and begins to increase as time goes on. Now, it never really got to be a horrible situation during the reign of Simon. However, in the reign of John Hyrcanus, who began the massive expansion of Judea, which I outlined last time, there began to be a great deal of concern on the parts of the Pharisee-dominated Sanhedrin. Specifically, they were concerned about three administrative policy areas and about their role in society as they perceived it. Now, let me show you what I mean by the... let me just list the policies. The leader was commander-in-chief and therefore was responsible for going out and leading the armies in war. In other words, leading them out into bloody battles, which of course every leader does. But he was also the high priest. Now, the Sadducees saw no problem with that. They were two separate roles. When he functioned as military leader, he was commander-in-chief. When he functioned as high priest, he was a priest. But the Pharisees didn't like this concept of a high priest responsible for shedding human blood in war. That's something that high priests had never done that before. This was something new. And it bothered them, this image of a high priest with human blood on his hands, in a sense, because he's responsible for leading his troops in war, and maybe even engaging in personal combat. It's not dissimilar to how many Catholics felt in medieval Europe when some popes like Julius II went out into battle and rather gloried in swinging that sword and hacking people down and so on. They didn't quite like the idea of the pope doing that. It seemed to violate what the pope should be in their mind. So this was the case here with the high priest. Secondarily, since they wanted, of course, to win the battles over their neighbors, and their neighbors did not use citizen troops, but they used paid, professional, highly skilled soldiers. If they were going to win out over their neighbors, the only way of doing it administratively is what? Hire your own body of paid, professional, highly skilled troops and recruit better ones, you see, so that you can win out over your neighbors. And so John Hyrcanus began the policy of using Greeks as paid mercenary soldiers of the Judean state to fight their battles. Now, actually, you know, how are you going to pay them? Well, you pay them a certain amount in cash, but what was the typical way Hellenistic societies paid their troops? Right. And so, under John Hyrcanus, they began to establish clerices, just like any other Hellenistic state, where when they were not in active military fighting, they had land that they worked, you know, on their own. And so there was the introduction of clerices on the typical Hellenistic model, as well as the bringing in of large numbers of Greeks to settle within, quote, the boundaries of Judea, you see. And bringing in, of course, all their cultural ways as well, because you couldn't force them to leave their cultural ways behind and live like Jews. And so they brought in their food, and their way of eating and their language, their Greek athletics, their pagan worship. Everything was brought in within their clerarchy, which was an exclusive Greek area, you know, when they took it over. Now, the Sadducees saw no problem with this, because after all, that's just normative for this area. That's how you run a state. There's not a Jewish way of running a state and a pagan way of running a state. There's a right way of running a state and a wrong way. There's a strong way and a weak way. And we want to do it right and strong instead of poor and weak. And so this just comes with the territory. But the Pharisee-dominated Sanhedrin was very concerned, because they saw these foreign influences being brought into Judea, sponsored by the state. They were very concerned about what impact this would have on Jews, who now were had close contact, in many cases, with these Greeks and their ways. Finally, the third policy that caused a great deal of disagreement during the days of John Hyrcanus was the policy of forced conversion of those they conquered. With the exception of the Samaritans, they forcibly converted the people they conquered to become Jews. Except where you've just had this whole solid block of Hellenistic people, it just wouldn't work. You know, ethnic Greeks, I'm talking about, that lived in the coastal plain in certain places. They did not attempt to convert them. But Galilee they converted, and they converted the Idumeans, the Edomites. Idumean is simply a more modern term to refer to Edomites that lived in this southern part of Judah, in the Negev Desert. So they forcibly converted them to Judaism. And of course, Herod the Great, as many of you are aware, was one of these Idumean people, you know, a generation or two later, whose ancestors had been forcibly converted to Judaism. The Pharisees were not against conversion per se, but they looked into the Bible, and all the examples of conversion that they saw in the Bible were people who chose voluntarily to take up the burden of living by God's laws, and did it because they wanted to identify with Israel and they wanted to identify with God's laws. There was a voluntary coming under the rule of God. They didn't see any examples of forced conversion. They found extermination of enemies, but not forced conversion. And so they were very upset about this. They were also upset because they say, what is going to happen if you have a large body of forcibly converted people? You're never going to drum all the pagan influences out of their heads just because they've become Jews. They're still going to think and react a lot of like pagans. They're going to mix in their Jewish religious worship pagan influences and pass that on to their children, who then will marry ordinary Jews, because Jews are Jews, and then pass it on to their children. We're going to go back to the problems of Ezra and Nehemiah when these people were marrying unconverted people. Because maybe be outwardly Jewish, but inwardly, you know, are they really sincerely Jewish? They began to doubt this, and they felt we're going to end up with a highly syncretetic religion, and that's not the word, right? A religion with a high degree of syncretism, a mixing of Jewish and pagan practices and ideas. So they were very, very worried about this mixing, as I say, of insincere converts with the main Jewish community. This was something that was a very big problem for them. I might say that this problem was not without later precedents. Obviously, the Muslims had similar concerns when they expanded their rule. And even in Spain in the 15th century, late 15th and 16th century, there was a similar problem as well. You know, about what do you do with these insincere, at least you assume insincere converts. So these tensions began to build in the reign of John Hyrcanus over these three major policies. As I said, the fact that the high priest was a military leader and therefore had human blood on his hands, the fact that they were employing paid professional Greek soldiers and settling them on Jewish land and allowing them to live as Greeks in their midst. And the third thing, that they were bringing in these large numbers of possibly insincere converts who would bring pagan ideas and practices into Judaism. Now, the Pharisees began to look at society in much the way of the diagram I'm going to put on the board. And I think that this diagram will help you to visualize their view of society, that this rectangle represents the totality of society. And this heavy dividing line represents the separation. I suggest that you leave a hole in it, though. This heavy dividing line with a hole in the middle of the line represents the division between the secular side of life and the religious. Now, under the secular, of course, we have government, we have the economy, we have social customs, manners of dress, manners of speech, manners of daily living. These are all belonging to the secular side. In the religious side, we have the sacrificial system, we have the teaching of the law, and we have synagogue worship. I shouldn't say synagogue worship, I should say worship synagogues, where, of course, the people came to worship. And be instructed in God's law. Now, the Pharisees began to see the secular side of society steadily and increasingly becoming Hellenized again. Simply because in so many ways, in terms of structure, in terms of operation, the government was functioning like a typical Hellenistic state. And so therefore, it was steadily increasing the Hellenistic content of daily living. So the secular sphere was becoming increasingly more Hellenized. And what is ironic is that the very family that led the rebellion to, you might say, rid Judea of Hellenistic influences is the same family, when they comes their lot to rule, that introduces so many of these influences back into Judea. And of course, they weren't doing it alone, because who were their closest associates? Those they worked with most closely in government and administration. The high-ranking administrative priests and the secular nobles, the very groups that had been openly favorable to Hellenization before the persecution of Antiochus Epiphanes. They certainly weren't going to object that the ruler was introducing many of these things. They had been in sympathy with that all along. And so the secular side of life was becoming increasingly Hellenized. The question was, would this spill over into the religious? The Pharisees saw themselves like that famous little Dutch boy, you know, with his finger in the dike. Only they didn't have their finger in the dike. They were propping up this wall of separation between the religious and secular spheres of society. That was their job, to reinforce this wall of separation to prevent the Hellenistic influences from getting into the religious side of life. The problem with their efforts is there was a gaping hole in the wall of separation. That hole was the dual position of the ethnarch and high priest. The leader was both ethnarch and high priest. And he was trying to tell the Pharisees, when I am working as an ethnarch, I think Hellenistically. But when I'm working as high priest, I think Judaically or Hebraically. I don't carry my Hellenistic influences into my work as high priest. I separate them in my mind. Now, would you be very convinced of that argument? Not really. I mean, how are you going to completely wall off the religious functioning, you know, from any of those Hellenistic influences? And so as you look at this diagram, you can see what the situation was. The secular side of life is increasingly more Hellenized, both because of government policy and the sympathies of the Sadducees, who, remember, are made up of the upper echelon priests and the secular nobles, who were the ones who were always sympathetic to Hellenization. The religious side of life is, they're trying to maintain it in its ancient separateness, And the only ones who are really working very hard to do that are the Pharisees and those that support them. And they're trying to prop up this wall of separation, and they are dismayed because maybe nothing's getting through the wall, but you have this big gaping hole in the middle and everything is pouring out through that hole. How would you then plug the gap in the hole, in the wall? What's the only practical way of plugging the gap? That's another reason why I gave you the diagram. I think you can see what policy the Pharisees would advocate as a way of creating an impenetrable wall of separation between the secular side of life and the religious. Mr. Heisler. Yeah. If you separate the two offices, then you don't have him standing there in the gap. You close the wall. You leave the ethnarch on the Hellenized side, secular side, and you leave the high priest on the secure religious side of life. You separate out these two offices. The ethnarch belongs there, and the high priest belongs there. Now, John Hyrcanus was not very sympathetic to this demand that began to increase from the Pharisees in the Sanhedrin. Let's understand why he didn't want to separate the two offices. As high priest and ethnarch, which position gave him the greatest prestige inside of Judea? The high priest. But outside, when he was relating to his fellow Hellenistic kings, which position gives him more importance? The ethnarch position. Let's understand why. Because in typical Hellenistic countries, how is the high priest chosen? He's just a political flunky appointed at the will and pleasure of the ruler. The high priest in a Hellenistic state is not an influential figure. He's just a flunky who serves at the will of the ruler. The important person is the king in a Hellenistic state. So if he goes to other rulers and says, I am the high priest of Judea, they say, oh yeah, I've got those and they serve at my pleasure. You're just not very impressive to me as high priest. If he comes and says, I am ethnarch of Judea, oh, well, you're the ruler. Okay, you I treat with as an equal, you see. So Hyrcanus is not willing to see someone else enjoy a lot of power with his neighbors. Why? Because he knows human nature. Let's say he chose to remain high priest. He would maintain a lot of influence inside of Judea. But the man he appointed as civil ruler would achieve more influence with his neighbors. And human nature being what it is, what's likely to happen with this other person? What do you think he might decide to think and do and so on, Dan?
Well, obviously, he might decide that he can get rid of.
Yeah, he can get rid of John Hyrcanus and appoint somebody else as high priest who would not threaten him, you see. And so John doesn't like that idea. He says, well, what if I choose the ethnarchy to protect myself, and I appoint somebody else as high priest? You know, if he decides the two of us don't get along, trading on his important role within Judea as high priest, he might stir the people to rebellion against me and get rid of me. You see, he's afraid to let go of either office because they're both levers of power. And he's afraid that anyone who gets his hand on the other lever is going to be a threat to him. And so he refuses to give it up. The Pharisees begin to turn on the screws. They begin to approve, they refuse to act on proposed laws. They refuse to act on new policies. The government begins to come screeching to a halt because they need to have opinions rendered by the Sanhedrin before they can institute new laws and institute new policies. The government is becoming hamstrung, which sometimes approaches that seriousness when we have, let's say, a president in one party and a Congress that's dominated by the other, and they have strong philosophical differences. Government is hamstrung to a degree because they can't get anything done on these vital issues where they differ so much. Well, this is what was happening in Judea. Government was coming screeching to a halt. Now, what he did is he reduced the pressure by promising, since he had two sons, that he allow one of his sons to become high priest and the other to become the ethnarch. And thereby there would begin to be a separation. And that the descendants of the older, who should naturally inherit the high priesthood because of the laws of inheritance, they would remain as the high priest, and then the descendants of his younger son would continue to serve as the civil leaders And being of the same family, there wouldn't be this likelihood of one trying to take over everything, and it would satisfy the Sadducees and the Pharisees. They would not have a problem. And so the Pharisees said, okay, we'll bide our time, we'll wait for your sons to succeed you, and we'll get what we want. Because all we're interested in is safeguarding the religious side of life. And as long as you promise to let one be the high priest and the other the ethnarch, we're happy. John Hyrcanus dies in 104. What happens? Judah Aristobulus looks at the situation and says, I don't like it. I insist on being both. And so he served as both. The Pharisees felt betrayed, and they began to get angry and stir and mutter and gather in small groups and complain to each other and say, you know, this is not right. This is not what we were promised. The tempers begin to rise. The temperature goes up. And then within a year, Judah dies. And his brother inherits both offices. And so they begin to make similar demands of Jonathan that he give up one of the offices. And they completely bring the government to a halt. Now what happens? Civil war. Jonathan will not give in. The Pharisees will not give in. There is civil war in the nation over the issue of whether the ethnarch and high priest can be the same person. You might say the match that set off all this accumulated hard feelings was the fact that Jonathan Alexander just did something the Pharisees just said, that's the limit. That's the straw that broke the camel's back. He declares himself king of Judea. Not only did he declare himself king, but up until the time he made that decision, all of his coins reflected the dual role of the ethnarch and the Sanhedrin in deciding policies of the state. The coins would say Jonathan Alexander, high priest, and the council of the Jews, the Hevah HaYehudim, showing who was running the country. Now the coins just said Jonathan Alexander, high priest, and Basileus, king. No mention of the legislative body at all. And that was the way he wanted to run his government. Absolute monarchical authority. And that was the straw that broke the camel's back, civil war. How far did the Pharisees carry their anger? This is an interesting point. They actually approached the Seleucid rulers of Syria and said, if you will send troops and get rid of this guy, Jonathan, we will join your empire as your subject territory. We will give up our independence as long as you guarantee our religious autonomy. The Pharisees were so hep on protecting the religion, they were willing to sacrifice the independence of the state to do it, that the Seleucid ruler would help them. Fortunately, he was too busy with other things to apply much significant help. But Jonathan got really scared. And so there was a compromise. The compromise was, guess what? He remains high priest and ethnarch, no longer king. King is out. The Pharisees are put back into influential positions in the government in the Sanhedrin, and the promise is renewed that among his two sons there will be a separation. Is that an untypical government approach to problems? How often in our government do we sort of postpone the solution to the next generation? If you study a lot of our government policies, it tends to be a typical approach. Anyway, that's how it got patched up. And we will resume with what happens in the next generation, though you may want to, you probably can guess. History does tend to repeat itself. We'll start with Hyrcanus and Aristobulus next time.